Hi. In today's episode, a social calamity. One United Nations envoy gives his verdict on austerity Britain. And former US Secretary of State John Kerry tells us how Donald Trump is making the world more dangerous.
They expect you to live on £552 a month, even though my bills come to £580. So I'm in a deficit, and that's not even including my gas and electric. And if it wasn't for the food bank, I don't know what I'd be doing now, because I'm already making debt by being poorly.
I've got bedroom tax to pay for two bedrooms, even though I don't sleep with my husband. I've never slept with him for near on 20 years because he's an alcoholic, but I've still got to pay the bedroom tax. And just can't make ends meet. I did leave him, but I felt sorry for him, and I've been with him 41 years this year. So sometimes I love him and sometimes I don't, if you know what I mean.
I've got me two little cats and me two budgies. I love animals. And I've got a little bungalow, little flat with a nice garden. And I'm never out of it. I love me garden. I get all me food in the garden. I've got a little table there. I'm just on me own. I find it very lonely, but what can you do about it, you know? We do get a little bit of money. I mean, some people get nothing, you know? I've seen them on the telly. They haven't got any food. I'm out in these foreign countries. I sometimes cry. When I get sick, no, I haven't got much, and I look at them, they've got nothing. It's a funny world, you know. There's always been rich and poor, and they'll always be the same, you know.
This year, 42,000 people have used the West End Food Bank in a small porter cabin in the suburbs of Newcastle-upon-Tyne. Claire, Janet and Keith are just three of them. This month, a lawyer called Philip Alston, the UN's Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, has made a two-week journey around the UK. The Guardian's Rob Booth and Today in Focus producer Joshua Kelly followed him on his journey. He came to examine the impact of a decade of austerity, and Newcastle was one of the first places he visited. On Friday, he released his findings in a damning report, which stated that poverty was a political choice in the UK and a disgrace. From The Guardian, I'm India Rackerson. Today in Focus, what does poverty look like in one British city?
So, over to you.
Thanks very much. So I do want to start first of all by thanking the British government.
Rob, you've just been to the press conference. What did you think when you opened the report?
Well, the language is immediately extraordinarily strong. I think in the first line he talks about
is a lot of misery,
great of misery being caused in the country. He was talking about punitive, mean-spirited, and often callous austerity policies. And
the child poverty rates are staggering.
Child poverty levels he was describing that were a social calamity. So it had this real tone of, it was portentous, and it felt like, I mean, we did see some people in terrible circumstances, and I did get the impression that he didn't feel any fear or favour about the British government. He was going to say what he thought about
the
things.
The public lands that are being sold off, the libraries that are being closed down, the youth centres that are being downsized, and soon there will be nowhere for people in the lower income groups to go.
But you often don't expect this kind of frankness from officialdom.
So, Rob, who is Philip Alston? What's he doing here?
He's a UN rapporteur on extreme poverty and human rights. And so what that means is he travels around the world, he goes to different countries and finds out if they're living up to their commitments in terms of international human rights agreements. He's interested really in austerity in the UK.
And Sheila Philip, who's part of the visit, and was hoping to maybe have a chat. Would you be happy to have a chat?
Yeah. You come here often?
What is he like?
Well, he's a very sort of urbane, calm lawyer in his 60s from Australia, and he's got a very dry sense of humour.
I know, I'm sorry about that. That's my fault, I think, but we're trying.
And he is a very good listener from what I've seen.
So, Rob, take us back 2 weeks to the start of Alston's tour. Newcastle was one of the first places he visited, and you went along with him. Why did he go there?
Well, it's a classic post-industrial northern city. It's divided in some ways. There's a two-track kind of city, isn't it? There's some really booming areas in the economy there, and you can see that all around you. It's very confident, and it's got this rapidly growing tech and creative sector. But at the same time, it does have these very serious pockets of deprivation. More than a fifth of the city's population are living in some of the most deprived wards in the country. Child poverty there is much higher, about 50% higher than the national average as well.
What sense of a picture of poverty did you get from the city?
Well, obviously it's bound to be limited, only spending, you know, a day there. But there was one kind of common theme that started to emerge, and that was a specific physical journey that quite a few people in Newcastle have to make when they fall into that sort of trouble. And it's quite neatly reflected in the different places that Philip Alston visited when he came to the city. So basically we were able to follow him around, and the people were making the same journey. And that was really from the job centre to the Citizens Advice Bureau and then onto the food bank. People's journey often begins at the job centre, and the one that Philip Alston visited is the big one near the big market, right in the city centre, surrounded by lots of nice bars and restaurants. It's not the most welcoming place. We tried to get in ourselves, and there was a bluff security guard who said we couldn't stay inside. No, it was a bit frustrating. Yeah. It was a kind of flavour, I think, of the sort of hostile environment that several of the claimants that we spoke to described at the job centre. It's not a comfortable place to be. The reason the job centre in Newcastle is important is that it's the first place that people come into contact with Universal Credit. And Newcastle is the first city that's rolled out Universal Credit. The thing about Universal Credit is that it has this 6-week gap in payments when you first go onto it. And that's leaving families with no money and often unable to afford bills and even food.
So, Rob, if you've been to the job centre, there isn't a job, or you can't work, and you've just found out that you're not going to have any money, perhaps for 6 weeks or even more, then what do you do?
So after the job centre, a lot of people feel that they need some help. So what they do is they walk across the town centre, it's about half a mile to the north, and they find the Citizens Advice Bureau, which is basically an umbrella organisation which helps people with advice and when things go wrong, debt, housing problems, legal problems, and obviously with benefits. It's up on the fourth floor of the main public library in the city centre, and we squeezed into the lift, very small lift actually, with Philip Alston and his entourage of 4 or 5 advisers to get up there. So Alston walks into a room, sits around a big table and starts talking to a whole group of people who've been getting advice from the CAB about their problems with the benefit system.
And who's there? Who's in the room?
Well, one of the people he was talking to was a guy called Thishara Chandrasiri. You could just see that he was really eager to tell Alston his story. He was kind of biting his lip, just dying to be heard.
So I've got a physical impairment, which I've had since 2005, and it affects my balance and my strength and my grip, and it's nothing that'll go.
He explained to Alston that when he changed over to Universal Credit, he had to do a whole bunch of physical tests to keep his benefits.
Was the work capability assessment. So they wrote back saying, sorry, you're not entitled to anything. We're giving you, on their point system, they gave me 0 points. Across the board.
So no impairment?
No.
What was the assessment that they did? Was it just someone asking you a few questions?
Yeah, so they asked a few questions, asked like a few very basic tests.
Was it physical? Were they physical tests?
Yeah, so like things like picking things up and standing up, etc. And then I even provided all the doctor's notes and things like that. And what I found quite disgusting is that they said, you've had your condition for a long time, you should be used to it by now. In their actual report, they wrote that. And also, because I'm right-handed as well, they said, well, you've got a left hand, so use that.
I mean, that is quite a shocking thing to be told. How did the room react to that?
Well, there was a pretty audible gasp in the room. I mean, Alston had heard some difficult things, but I think that was probably one of the most memorable. And Fishara said that he ended up losing more than half of his benefits after that test.
Wow. Who else was there that you heard from?
Well, one of the people was a woman called Tracy Whittenstall, who I spoke to outside the room after the meeting. She'd also just changed onto Universal Credit because of what she said was an administrative error. Her payments as a result were delayed not for 5 or 6 weeks, but for 10 weeks. So she went into rent arrears, she was served an eviction notice, and she fell further into debt. But the thing that really stood out was the fact that she couldn't afford her the bus fare for her son to go to school, who was just preparing for his GCSEs.
The money to get him there, because it's quite far from where I live, his school.
And she didn't feel that she could afford to pay his lunch money as well. And the result was that she didn't send him to school.
He just didn't go?
Well, for several of the weeks, I think she said, during that period when she had no money, he didn't go. And she said that he was on to get all A grades, but he actually got lower grades as a result in his exams, in his GCSEs, which just seems, well, it just seemed terrible.
He got Bs when his potential was As and A stars. He was a couple of marks off A star, but he could have done a lot better.
Yeah.
Obviously, if he had been attending, and it was a very critical time at school for him.
The visible costs of this, aren't
they? She went to the Citizens Advice Bureau when things were particularly desperate.
And I spoke to a guy here who was like, how are you managing with other things? How are you getting on with your budget and your food? And I was like, that is the thing that, it's a thing that no one likes to talk about, is you can't feed your family. It's a difficult one. A member of staff had said, we can help you out with that, which I didn't know that was available. So it was just like a relief of, thank you so much, someone is listening, and thank you for helping me out for this few days. I don't think anyone deserved the position we're put in, because I wasn't in work at that time. It's my worst time in my whole life, and I'm quite a happy person, but no.
Rob, understandably, she sounds really upset here by what's happened to her.
Yeah, there were tears in her eyes when she was trying to talk about it. She didn't break down, because she's obviously used to it now, but very tough for her.
Rob, at this point in the day on your journey with Philip Alston, what are you starting to sort of realise and feel about this trip?
Well, I think what's starting to emerge is that there are not just a few people who are suffering from difficulties with poverty in Newcastle, but it's a kind of systemic problem. You know, the people at the job centre, the people at the advice bureau, they are dealing with this on a, you know, kind of semi-industrial scale. What that boils down to is about choices, about political choices, and that you know, we've decided as a society that this is the this is the way we're going to spend our money, this is the way we're going to tax our society, and those kind of fiscal choices are playing out in the difficulties that a lot of these people are enduring. And when you're seeing them up close and talking to people about it, you realise that has a kind of strong effect on their humanity, if you like, on their human rights, as Alston would see it. And it does appear to be impinging on their, you know, right to, you know, live a decent life, effectively, right to food, those sorts of things that I think most people would agree are reasonable.
So from Citizens Advice, what is the next stage for a lot of people in this journey?
Citizens Advice gave Tracy a voucher for a food bank, and that's what happens to a lot of people that we spoke to. And the food bank that they refer them to is in the west end of Newcastle, which is about 3 miles across town. It's quite a long walk, and it's a walk that a lot of people do have to make, because we're told they can't afford the bus fare. So we arrived a little bit before Philip Olson's delegation. There's a really busy scene. There was piles of green crates full of groceries ready to be bagged up and taken away, and there's a sort of small kitchen area where a lady called Jill was standing behind the counter shouting out the food that was on offer, and there were two or three cooks behind her slaving away, putting together some quite tasty smelling dishes. The West End Food Bank's the biggest food bank in the UK. They give out about 11 tonnes of food a month. I think demand is increasing by, well, has increased about 20% in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
There's folk coming and going with parcels of food, and some people are stopping and having something to eat and a cup of tea and some biscuits. And at one table was a woman called Denise with her son Michael.
My name's Michael Hunter.
No, I'm Denise Hunter.
And what's your relationship?
Mother and son.
Thank you.
My baby boy.
Everything was going fine for Denise's family until her husband got ill and lost his work. And then they found themselves on universal credit, and that meant that they only had £485 a month to get by on for a family of three.
If your electric goes off, basically, and you've got nothing to put on it, it's either hunting for candles, which is dangerous.
Yeah.
So what electricity I've got on, I try to save it as quick as possible so you can walk around the house without hurting yourself. And like, cooking is a nightmare. Especially when you've got a son who likes pizzas and you try to do them as quick as you can in the microwave, it doesn't turn out right. Yes.
Microwave pizza. Microwave, not quite as tasty.
Honest, they're horrible.
They like, just go really oily.
Yeah.
And it's just horrible.
Do you feel like you're getting enough food?
No, not really.
Are you hungry sometimes?
Sometimes. It's just we're scared to actually eat in case we're running out of food.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just horrible.
Yeah. There's a lot of anger about it.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. They will end up, as I say once again, with riots. Like, if people can't buy things for their bairns for Christmas, if they haven't got the money, I can say shop windows and robberies and things.
Yeah.
Because, as I say, parents will do anything for their bairns.
Yeah.
Rob, that was your trip to Newcastle last week, and then Philip Elston visited more cities across the UK, and his report came out this Friday. What does it say?
Well, he ripped into the government's austerity programme and identified universal credit, the big welfare reform, as one of the things that was causing the most suffering, and the way that it was impinging more on women, children, disabled people, and that human rights agreements that the government had made were being breached. It was interesting when he was talking about the impact on women, because he basically said,
if you had got a group of misogynists in a room and said, guys,
said that if a group of misogynists had got together in a room, they wouldn't have come up with a policy like this if they could have tried, in terms of it weighing against women in particular. So he was very, very strong on that.
That's really damning.
It was very damning. And his attitude towards child poverty was, you know, a social calamity and an economic disaster. The really crucial point that I think he wanted to make was that austerity was not just an economic necessity, but rather it had been a political choice. And he used the language of social re-engineering.
I think if I was a Conservative cabinet minister, I'd be delighted, because I think they've brought about a revolution. I think this is what Margaret Thatcher wasn't able to do, but it certainly implements her vision. That there is no such thing as a society, that individuals are on their own or with their families. And I think the message is that if you can't cope on your own, good luck.
And have the government responded to the report?
Yeah, the government have responded strongly. They say they do not recognise at all what he says, and that they talk about increasing wages and high levels of employment.
So without sounding too bleak then, what is the point of all this, his visit, if he's not going to be listened to by the government?
Well, he's very hopeful, as he perhaps should be, that the Department of Work and Pensions might grasp this. The Select Committee on Work and Pensions, led by Frank Field, has said that it's going to look at it very closely. And of course, all the charities that work in this world are completely emboldened by what he said. They feel that he's hit the nail on the head.
Great. Thank you so much, Rob.
Thank you.
You can read more from Rob Booth on Philip Alston's report at theguardian.com. Coming up next, former US Secretary of State John Kerry on how it feels to watch Donald Trump unravel the work of previous administrations in areas including climate change, Iran, and North Korea. Welcome back. Last week, former Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry talked about his new memoir, Every Day is Extra at a Guardian Live event. Before he took to the stage, he told us how it feels to see President Trump attempt to undo the work he did as Secretary of State under the Obama administration.
I'm proud of a life of public service with a lot of different chapters. I've said to people, and I mean this completely, I don't take it personally. I really don't. But I'm upset for the world. I'm upset for the substance of what has been changed here. But I'm also proud of the fact that both the Paris Agreement, which I had the privilege of leading negotiations on, or the Iran deal, are still there. They haven't been blown away. It's just that the President of the United States pulled out. But back in September in New York, Britain, Germany, France, China, Russia sat down with the Iranian foreign minister and all agreed they want to try to keep this deal. They want to keep the agreement. Major players in the security apparatus of our country, General Mattis, former Secretary Tillerson, believed we should keep this deal because it's working. And that if you want to pressure Iran, then tell the Iranians, we'll give you a year. We're going to pull out of this deal if you don't fix it. But we want to have the follow-on agreement to deal with your missiles, to deal with Hezbollah, to deal with Yemen. And then you have some leverage. You get everybody on your side. Right now, the president's isolated. He doesn't have everybody on his side. So I think it's been a mistake. I think it's a mistake for the world. I think it makes the world more dangerous. But that's the way I look at it. This is not about, it's not anything to do with me. It has everything to do with preventing a country from having a nuclear weapon and engaging in countries in a way that your word means something. I mean, if you say to them, we're going to live by this, and then you suddenly another president comes along, oh, I'm out. Boy, it gets hard to start to negotiate things for the long term. I'm very concerned about what's taking place in North Korea, because North Korea, as we all saw on the front pages of newspapers a couple of days ago, is continuing to develop nuclear weapons, continuing to deploy those nuclear weapons, and doing it secretly. So in effect, it makes it look like the President of the United States has been completely hoodwinked. He went to a meeting. They had a big meeting in Singapore. Our president stands up and says, I love Kim Jong-un, and the threat's been dealt with. Well, the threat obviously hasn't been dealt with. And so we cannot have major leaders of major nations living in an alternate reality.
You can watch the video of the event with John Kerry on our website. That's it for this episode. If you're liking what you're hearing on the podcast, then hit subscribe. My thanks to Rob Booth and John Kerry and everyone at the Newcastle West End Food Bank. And special thanks to Sylvie Fish and Alison Atkinson-Phillips from the Food Bank Histories Research Team. Today's producers were Joshua Kelly, Mythili Rao and Rachel Humphreys, with sound design by Axel Cacoutier. The executives were Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow. Bye.